And we are joined here live in our KODX studios by Maria Tomchik, local writer and activist, here to not really give us a wrap-up of the past week's news, but in fact, you are giving us a kind of a wrap-up of the past year's news.
Yeah, the most overhyped and underreported stories. Last week, we started with the local ones, and I gave the overhyped and about half of the underreported stories for the year in local politics, and I wanted to wrap up those local stories, and then I'll talk about national, international.
Yeah, because we've been hanging on the edge of our seat since then, and my seat's getting pretty sore.
Okay, so just to recap our underreported local stories from last week, number one was that, yes, the Seattle Police Department is still engaging in racial bias, according to their own statistics and their own reports filed with the U.S. District Court judge in Seattle. Number two was the one-night count of the homeless gave us a very valuable picture of who the homeless are, and they're not who the mainstream media in Seattle and Seattle conservatives think that they are. Number three was that local environmentalists pushed the Seattle City Council to pass a Green New Deal for Seattle in August, and that the Seattle City Council is already using it as a blueprint for legislation that they are working through in their committees and have passed some legislation already based on the Green New Deal that passed in August. And number four was that the city cut a sweetheart deal with Alexandria Real Estate Equities on the Mercer Mega Block sale, and that other development companies had proposed
offered more.
Yeah, they had made proposals to the city of Seattle for more affordable housing than Alexandria Real Estate had proposed, and that because Alexandria Real Estate has worked with South Lake Union developers before on big projects in South Lake Union, because they owned parcels very close to and in right next to the Mercer Mega Block, they got a sweetheart deal from the city, and it was very profitable for them.
And they call it sweetheart because the city is basically treating them like a date that they're hoping to get something out of.
Yeah, and I pointed out last week too, the Mercer Mega Block deal actually provides more space in its below ground parking garage to house automobiles than square footage to house low income people in the so-called affordable housing piece of the Mercer Mega Block deal, and that the proceeds from the sale are what really spurred Mayor Durkin and city council members to approve the deal, not so much the affordable housing piece. So number five on the list, to carry on from where we left off last week, number five on the list is the Adley Shepard arbitration scandal and the fallout from that case. Early this year, it leaked that lawyers with the Seattle Police Officers Guild conspired with Seattle city attorneys to delay the arbitration agreement over Officer Adley Shepard's disciplinary case until after the city council voted to approve the Seattle Police Officer Guild's labor contract last November. Shepard was the cop who punched a handcuffed woman in the back of his patrol car in 2014. In 2016, he was fired by then Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole. Shepard enlisted his union, the Seattle Police Officers Guild, to help him win reinstatement with back pay through the arbitration process. That arbitration agreement was finished and ready to be announced last October 31st. But the Seattle Police Officers Guild and the police department sat on the ruling for more than 3 weeks. This is with the help of Seattle city attorneys for political reasons. They didn't want the arbitration ruling to influence the Seattle City Council to reject the new Seattle Police Officers Guild labor contract. That contract had already drawn fierce criticism from the Community Police Commission and 24 community groups, who had all urged the city council to reject the contract because it rolled back a number of police reforms, especially the process through which the Seattle Police Department disciplines officers who use excessive force, like Adley Shepard. Early this year, Judge James Robart agreed with them and ruled that the city was partially out of compliance with court-mandated police reforms. He ordered the city to come up with a plan to get back into compliance, but the mayor has stalled on that, hiring a consulting firm to write a report that largely it was released this month, largely agrees with the Community Police Commission's criticisms of the contract, but doesn't really offer any path forward. So essentially, hiring that consulting firm means that Mayor Durkan has just stalled for several months on coming up with a solution to the gridlock. And the ball is now in Judge Robart's court. And I think early this coming year, we're going to see a ruling from him as to what the city needs to do to get back in compliance.
So not a real good indicator of leadership from Durkan there?
No. In fact, I think her leadership there was to try to stall the process in order to get the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract approved by the city council and to basically hold off on coming up with any kind of renegotiations until the city has to open up new negotiations on a new contract, which will start early this coming year. And then I think she's hoping that the old contract will fall by the wayside. I think that's really what her strategy is. Now, number six on my list is that Mayor Jenny Durkan and Donald Trump share a very bad habit, acting department heads. Durkan's head of the Human Services Department, Jason Johnson, still has not been confirmed by the Seattle City Council. In fact, Durkan pulled his nomination in late April, saying that she'd try again in 2021. or 2021, hoping to get a friendlier lineup of city council members in this year's election. But of course, that didn't happen.
That didn't work.
No. Johnson has now been serving as the interim director of the Human Services Department for almost 2 years without confirmation. According to Human Services Department employees, after the former director left, Mayor Durkan had promised that she would conduct an open search for a new permanent director. But the mayor surprised everyone on New Year's Eve last year by announcing that she had changed her mind and wanted the council to approve Johnson as permanent director. Johnson was working under the previous director. After protests from over 130 Human Services Department employees and a letter of protest from a group of social services providers who help seniors, people of color, and the disabled, three city council members, Shama Sawant, Teresa Mosqueda, and Lorena Gonzalez asked Mayor Durkan to conduct an open search for a new director. And Shama Sawant refused to take up Johnson's nomination in her committee. That's what eventually triggered Mayor Durkan to withdraw Jason Johnson's nomination. And I think that's also spurring some talk. I don't know how serious this talk is, that there may be some change in how the city council committees are set up with the new city council. There's some talk that there might be fewer committees and that not all city council members will have their own committee to chair. I think that's a move that's directly in response to Shama Sawant not bringing up Jason Johnson's nomination in her committee. We'll see if that's serious talk or if that's just rumor.
And where would that, who would be making the call on that?
That's a good question. I think the city council pretty much votes and determines on whether or not they have the number of committees that they have and whether or not everyone gets to chair a committee. And I think with this new city council, we have a majority of progressives on the council who are going to be opposing that. So that talk of restricting the number of committees and who gets to chair a committee might just be rumor.
Mm. Okay.
Now, number seven on the list is another Tim Iman initiative highlighted the need for a state income tax. There was a lot of coverage of I-976, and the mainstream media was really quick to list all the transportation cuts that would result from it. Tim Iman's latest $30 car tab bill. They were not quick to discuss the real solution to I-976, which is tax reform in Washington state. But it was really refreshing to hear a number of state politicians say on the morning after the election, I guess we need a state income tax now. A number of state legislators said that. And that means that hopefully that talk is going to translate into some action in the coming legislative session.
But did they say it in front of a microphone, or was this just kind of muttered under their breath while they were putting butter on the toast?
That's the question. You know, okay. How many of these folks said that and meant it, and are willing to stick to it in the coming legislative session. Now, just because corporate media can't envision paying their fair share of taxes, this doesn't mean that our elected representatives should drop the ball now, too. This is going to be one big, important legislative session coming up here. And in addition to going full on working out a way to cut climate change emissions by our state, we went a fair ways towards that in the last legislative session. But there was one big piece that the state legislature didn't tackle. That was the transportation piece. In addition to tackling that transportation piece, hopefully through a new transportation bill, the other big thing that the state legislature needs to tackle is tax reform. So we'll see what happens this coming legislative session once January rolls around and that legislative session starts up. Number 8 on my list is a Democratic majority in both houses of the state legislature passed a lot of great environmental bills this year. So that's kind of a lead-in to the last issue on my list that was underreported this year, from a bill to develop new energy standards in large buildings to a bill requiring all electrical utilities in the state to be 100% carbon neutral by 2030 and 100% carbon free by 2045. I think the Democrats really got the job done this year in Olympia. And with a governor who briefly ran for president as the climate change candidate, they should be able to tackle the elephant in the room, which, as I said, is cleaning up greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation sector. The transportation sector is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Washington state. We need a Green New Deal, not just for the city of Seattle, but for Washington state. And the transportation bill, cleaning up emissions in the transportation sector, that's been the Achilles heel for Democrats and Republicans for years in the state legislature, is working out and getting a transportation bill done. A large part of it is we don't have a decent tax structure in the state of Washington, and that puts a crimp on how much money can be allocated for transportation projects in the state of Washington. The Republicans are always pushing for more roads, money for roads and building roads. The Democrats are always pushing for money for multimodal transportation from transit, particularly big transit projects, all the way down to pedestrian and bicycle improvements. And the two have a hard time meeting on those two different priorities. In particular, more conservative Democrats tend to lean with the Republicans and look for money for roads, and that has to change. So we'll see if this year in Olympia, if the progressive Democrats, now that we have a new, more progressive Speaker of the House after Frank Chop retired, and now that we
as
have
a Speaker.
As Speaker of the House, yeah. And now that we have Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate, maybe we'll get some movement on a transportation bill that's more progressive, provides more money for transit and for transportation solutions that don't rely on gas, and also find a way to help clean up greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation sector for both automobiles and for trucks.
All right, we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Mm-hmm. So that wraps up the local underreported stories of the year. If you want to find out what our overhyped stories for the year are, you can go to our website, kodxseattle.org, click on the local shows on the top menu and select Eat the Airwaves. Go to our page on the KODX website, and you can find all of our back shows listed there. And you can listen
podcasts, yes.
As podcasts, and you can listen online.
So then that moves us on to national and international overhyped and underreported stories for the year.
Yeah, our national, international overhyped stories. I've got, let's see here, 6 or 7. I've got about 6 of those. Number 1 on that list is the invading hordes from south of the border wall. U.S. intelligence agencies Worldwide Threat Assessment, which was released last January, made no mention of a need for a wall on the southern border of the United States. It made no mention at all of immigration as a national security threat. And yet Donald Trump and the Republicans continued to play up caravans of immigrants, moving north towards the southern border with the United States and invading the U.S., et cetera, et cetera. Now, the Worldwide Threat Assessment issued by U.S. intelligence agencies also said that Iran is abiding by the 2015 nuclear agreement, but it named Russia as a leading threat because of its growing cyber weapons capability and the threat to the 2020 elections. Also issues that Donald Trump was trying to play down throughout the year by focusing instead on immigration as a terrible threat to U.S. Security, which it is absolutely not. And in fact, we've seen the impact on the U.S. economy, where many businesses in many different industries are suffering because we lack new workers coming into the United States to help staff the growing jobs that are available for them. Now, number two on my list of overhyped national, international stories is Trump's trade deals. Trump made a big deal about and the White House made a big deal about any time he met with anyone to talk about a trade deal. He announced towards the end of the year a trade deal, a first phase trade deal with China and the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, both of which are just very minor tweaks in business as usual. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement made very minor changes to NAFTA. It's essentially NAFTA 2.0. The U.S.-China trade deal, again, basically put into words, basically wrote down into words policies that China was already going to pursue in terms of purchasing U.S. goods. So essentially, it was business as usual. In the meantime, Trump's trade wars with China and Europe and the associated tariffs that have been levied on consumer goods coming into the United States, taxes which U.S. consumers are paying, have largely erased any tax savings middle-class Americans got with this 2017 tax cut. The tariffs have also slowed economic growth in the United States to a projected 2%, barely 2% this year, when the Republicans were expecting at least 3% growth in their conservative projections of U.S. growth. So while Trump overhypes his great trade deals, actually his trade wars are what he's been pursuing, and they've had a negative impact on the pocketbooks of Americans and on the U.S. economy, while his trade deals have done very little.
And they've had significant impact on states like ours, Washington State, mm-hmm. and the other blue states, as if he was aiming them specifically at, you know.
Well, the blue states tend to be along the coasts, and mm-hmm. the coasts are where a lot of international trade comes into coastal ports. And yes, Washington State, as well as Oregon, California, and many of the blue states along the eastern seaboard are heavily reliant on trade. So yeah, it's had a big impact on our economies, and yet our economies are not suffering quite that much because we also have a lot of heavy tech centers along the east and west coasts. So, you know, we're adapting. On the other hand, the industries in our states that rely on international trade are struggling.
Mm-hmm. Like food production.
Well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, because food could be going towards people that need to eat it.
Oh, well, yeah, we export a lot of food from Washington State in particular, and the countries that buy from us are not buying as much as they could be if Trump had not put up these trade barriers. So that is the underreported piece. Mm. That's the flip side of Donald Trump's overhyped trade deals. Number three on my list of overhyped is Trump's friendship with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. And in fact, North Korea has been firing off short-range ballistic missiles right and left in the past month and is back to issuing unflattering statements about Donald Trump, including their recent description of his actions as, quote, the relapse of the dotage of a dotard, referring to their original insult from 2017 when they called Trump a, quote, mentally deranged dotard, end quote. And this is getting a lot of coverage in the worldwide press, but not much coverage here at home. The world has been really uneasy about Donald Trump because they saw how erratic he was at the NATO summit in Europe last month. No one really in the global community wants to be his friend right now. I think they view his impeachment as just a matter of time before he's out of office. And I think there's a whole lot of folks in the global community who are thinking that Donald Trump is not going to win re-election. They're probably pretty clear-eyed about him not being kicked out of office through impeachment, but they're thinking he's not going to win re-election. So Trump is, and the White House continues to overhype his friendship with Kim Jong-un as a way to try to say, hey, we have great international relations with foreign dictators, you know. But in fact, he has very few friends in the global community. Number four on my list is the Republicans have a plan to replace Obamacare. There is no plan, period. There never has been a plan. It's been very clear, particularly this year, in a year when the Trump administration and Republican states have been aggressively pursuing court cases to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. There's actually no proposal on the part of the Republicans to replace it with anything substantial. That continues to be an overhyped promise from originating in Donald Trump's presidential campaign in 2016 when he stood up in a debate with Hillary Clinton and said, yeah, we have a great plan to replace Obamacare. There's no plan, and there never has been. Number five on my list is the whistleblower. The Republicans in the House and Senate and Donald Trump and his cronies in the White House have been yelling about the whistleblower for the past year. I guess, you know, since the whistleblower came forward in mid-year. Now, I just want to point out it wasn't just one whistleblower. It was six White House officials who overheard Trump's shakedown of the new Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, and they complained about it. And it was just one guy who came forward to say something about it to the House. Then 17 federal employees came forward to testify in the House of Representatives against Donald Trump and his cronies. So it wasn't just one whistleblower. It's never been just one whistleblower. It's been multiple people in the White House and who work in the federal government who have been appalled by Donald Trump's shakedown of the Ukraine for his own personal benefit. And that's the reason why Republicans in the Senate won't call witnesses in his trial. It's because they know that those witnesses will have some very incriminating things to say. It'll be interesting to see, though, after the first of the year, once legislators return to the House and the Senate, whether or not Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer can pressure Mitch McConnell to agree to witnesses in a Senate trial. Donald Trump has been pushing for witnesses to testify on his behalf, so Mitch McConnell may be getting pressure from the top to allow that to go forward. It'll be interesting to see in the beginning of this next year what that trial is going to shape up to be, if there is a trial.
Yeah. Still plenty of time for that to go every which way.
And there is, yeah. Now, number six on my list of overhyped is the do-nothing Democrats in the House. It's actually, I want to point out, the do-nothing Senate. The House this year voted to pass gun safety laws, environmental legislation, a $15 per hour minimum wage. In fact, the House passed over 400 bills this year, pretty on par with what House of Representatives usually passes in a given year. But about 80% of those bills went nowhere in the Senate. Instead, the Republican majority in the Senate chose to use their time to pack the federal courts with unqualified right-wing judges, many of whom have not seen any trial experience at all. They have zero trial experience, and a lot of them have very little legal experience at all. And now the Senate is refusing to hold a real trial in the Trump impeachment proceedings. Essentially, they're making a complete mockery of our nation's judicial system. that can all be laid at the feet of irresponsible Republicans. So it's not the do-nothing Democrat year, it's the irresponsible Republican year in the House of Representatives and the Senate.
Yeah, they have been busy.
They have been busy, just not been...
Doing anything.
Yeah, they just have not been doing anything even remotely responsible or really related to doing their jobs in a meaningful way.
Right, and it hasn't been getting...
much coverage at all. There's been very little coverage of the judicial candidates that the Republicans have been pushing through and appointing to these federal courts. Some of those, I have seen a few little articles here and there. They tend to be in local papers articles saying, "How did this person ever get appointed to a federal judgeship? You know, they have zero trial experience. Mm-hmm. They have no experience working for a law firm. You know, they're just out of law school." Things like that, mm-hmm. where it's just been appalling news, but the mainstream press, the corporate press, has not covered it at all.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So that brings us to the underreported. I've already sort of mentioned some underreported things as part of the overhyped stories. There's always a flip side to those overhyped stories. Mm-hmm. In my mind, the focus is on the corporate press and the Republicans always want your focus on the sideshow, not on the main show. So I talked a little bit about the main show there, but there were some stories that were underreported that really needed a lot more focus on them. Number one on my list, I'm trying to kind of rank them by severity. Number one on my list is the fact that we're running out of time to stop severe climate change. The ice sheets are melting much faster than predicted. That's the Greenland ice sheet as well as the Antarctic ice sheets. Climates are changing around the globe, especially in places where the growing season was already pretty fragile, places where the ecosystem is fragile and is being irreparably damaged by climate change, places like Australia, Central America, the African Sahel and parts of India and the Asian subcontinent. This year has seen apocalyptic wildfires that are doing irreparable damage to Australia, along with stronger, more intense storms like Hurricane Dorian, which parked itself directly over the Bahamas for a full day as a Category 5 hurricane, largely destroyed most of the infrastructure in the Bahamas. A very recent intense Arctic storm front, which covered almost the entire lower 48 states, including one storm front that we're experiencing right now that stretches from California all the way to the Carolinas and is parked over the Midwest. These are changes in global weather currents, including a weakening polar vortex, very similar to last January's weather, where we saw a weakening polar vortex that brought record storms to the United States and to Europe. This is becoming an annual thing, and it is directly related to climate change. We are also seeing sunny day flooding. It's becoming more frequent along coastlines from the eastern United States to Southeast Asia to Europe. Places like Venice, Italy, as well as many island nations are suffering irreparable loss of coastlines to rising sea levels. Meanwhile, the global protest movement, Extinction Rebellion, held massive demonstrations all across the globe, except for here in the United States, where the demonstrations were relatively small. And the global protest movement is being covered in the global press, but not here in the U.S. press. Now, the United Nations Emissions Gap report in late November showed that, for the most part, countries are failing to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, especially the two biggest emitters, the United States and China. Greenhouse gas emissions have grown by 1.5% every year during this decade. This means that deeper reductions will have to be made more swiftly to keep the world from experiencing the worst effects of climate change. Emissions must now be cut by 7.6% every year over the next decade. At the Global Climate Summit in Madrid, Spain, which was just recently concluded, the nations that have signed on to the Paris Accord largely failed to reach agreement on how to establish a worldwide carbon market and ways to help developing nations finance the conversion to zero emissions energy production. Those were the two main goals at the Conference of Parties, the 25th Conference of Parties, called COP25.
And, which was going to be held in Chile.
It was, yeah.
But there was so much unrest
in Chile, yeah, that they moved it to Madrid, Spain. Yeah.
So, yeah. Lots of unrest happening, which I'm not sure if that's on your list either.
I'll talk a little bit about some of that towards the end. But all right. The two main goals of COP25 were not met. And that was mainly because the main global greenhouse gas emitters put a kibosh on it. The United States said, no, we're not interested in reaching an agreement on a worldwide carbon market. China and India said, no, you know, we don't want a deal on how to finance conversion to zero emissions energy production by underdeveloped nations. Australia and Brazil stepped up and said, no, we want loopholes in the system. And the negotiations fell apart. That means that next year, there's right after the U.S. presidential elections, next year when the next global climate summit occurs, this is all going to have to be rehashed again, as well as having nations that have signed on to the Paris Accords come forward with stiffer requirements for cutting greenhouse gases. That was meant to be on the agenda next year. That's going to have to still be on there, as well as these two items that didn't get tackled this year. And that's news that we should have seen more coverage of here in the United States, and that we didn't. Number two on my list is the Trump administration's continuing immigration violations, very severe immigration violations. Now, the Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services admitted early this year that the Trump administration had begun separating parents and their children at the border and at ports of entry starting at least a year before May 2018, in fact, not long after Trump was sworn into office. So many children have been stolen from their families and then lost in the system that Health and Human Services now says that the total number is still unknown. But in November, new government data reported by the Associated Press and PBS shows that 69,550 migrant children, almost 70,000 migrant children, were held in U.S. custody, separated from their parents over the past year alone. This is not including the previous 2 years of the Trump administration. 70,000 children, more than in any other nation in the world and more than in any previous year. The trauma and abuse continues at record levels, and someone in the Trump administration should lose their job, should be impeached, just for this reason alone.
Just one person?
I'm thinking the guy at the top.
Would that be Mr. Miller?
No, that would be Mr. Trump. Miller can go with him out the door. But right. Yes, I think Donald Trump should be impeached for this reason alone. Now, this is on top of continuing efforts by the Trump administration to strip immigrants of habeas corpus rights, to do away with bail hearings, to revoke all rights to claim asylum in the United States, and many, many other immigration violations by the federal government itself at the direction of Donald Trump, with Stephen Miller whispering in his ear. Now, more than 800,000 asylum cases are pending in the courts, and the current wait time is almost 2 years for people claiming asylum, as Donald Trump has refused to appoint more immigration judges to deal with the backlog. That, too, is another instance in which the Trump administration, Donald Trump, just cannot do his job, should be removed from office. Number three on my list.
Before you jump to that, can I just interject that, again, the fight for correcting the immigration violations has been well fought here locally mm-hmm. by different organizations, including the UW Center for Human Rights has been doing amazing work this last year, the last several years, getting out information regarding flights that ICE has been doing for extracting people from the local community and bringing people from across the country into some of the prisons, the private prison systems here, the one down in Tacoma. And they've been tracking that and managed to get Seattle, the King County Airport, to agree to stop accepting those flights, which was really key. And they're now happening through Yakima. But that was seen nationally as a major move where, again, local communities do have an impact on these national issues if people just, you know, get together and fight that.
And protests have continued at detention facilities, too. One of the big news stories this past year was the horrifying conditions in detention facilities down at the border. Those conditions continue to be an issue all across the United States as immigrants are transferred between facilities, often with no notice given to their lawyers or to their families as to where those folks are being transferred to, and the conditions that they're being kept in, and many of them in detention for indefinite periods of time, again, a violation of their rights. So that, too, is also something that is part of the story.
And some of these minors, these kids, are being held in facilities that aren't showing up on any of the official radars, on any of the official lists. One of those is in Cowlitz County here in Washington. And again, UW Center for Human Rights, trying to get information on that. Mm-hmm. And just to get, because the ICE and Homeland Security is saying, oh, no, these are clearly people who are threats to, you know,
right,
U.S.
teenagers.
Security. And yet they won't.
Separated from their parents.
They won't. aren't forthcoming with any details on who these kids are and or their threats, you know, and their families can't figure out where the kids are. And again, just another example of local organizations. And I know there's organizations across the country that are doing good work on this. But again, example of a local organization that's having a significant impact on this, mm-hmm, and being an example to others across the country that even though things are occurring at a federal level on a lot of this stuff, you can still
have an impact at the local level,
yeah,
if you join forces with groups that are working on these issues. And the UW Center for Human Rights is one of those groups.
Yeah.
La Resistencia also
a key organization.
Works here in the local
been
area.
Fighting this for years.
Fighting a lot of the problems in local detention centers, like the Northwest Detention
and
Center.
And regularly having a presence outside the Northwest Detention Center, mm-hmm, and you know, fighting for the people inside there.
Yeah.
So sorry for that little sidetrack.
No, that's good. Thank you, Mike.
But you have more.
I do.
Your list.
I do. Number three on my list is the new gag rule. On February 22nd, the Trump administration announced that it would pull federal funding from any family planning clinics that provide referrals for abortion services. Clinics could talk to patients about abortion, but could not tell them where to get one. In addition, clinics would no longer be required to provide women with all the options available to them, which means that anti-abortion groups could, for the first time, qualify for federal funding under Title X. Also, organizations that receive federal funding under Title X could still perform abortions, but they would have to perform them in an entirely separate facility with separate financial accounting from all other health services that the facilities provide. More than 4,000 clinics in the U.S. received Title X funding up to that point, and about 40% of those clinics were run by Planned Parenthood. 23 states quickly filed suit on behalf of low-income patients, many of whom are women of color or rural residents in those states, including the state of Washington. While lower courts issued injunctions against the rule, appeals courts overturned those injunctions, and the rule took effect this summer, putting the reproductive health care of 4 million low-income and rural women at risk. The Title X is a law that was passed by Congress in 1970, almost 50 years ago, to provide funding for family planning services. Federal law already prohibited the use of Title X money for abortions, except in the case of rape, incest, or to save the life of the woman. Instead, Title X money was paying for clinics to provide contraceptive services, cancer screenings, treatment for sexually transmitted diseases, and general health care treatment for many women. Their family planning provider is their primary health care provider. Now, excuse me. Now, women, particularly low-income women, and minority women will still have access to some of those services, but not others. So, for example, they may still be able to get low-cost cancer screening, but not get any contraceptive services at all, and not just abortion services, but in some of the clinics that are opening with Title X money, who are anti-abortion clinics, they may still be able to get cancer screening and healthcare advice, but they will not be able to get a prescription, for example, for the pill or diaphragm or another kind of contraceptive service. That is criminal, as far as I'm concerned. But that is the new gag rule here in the United States, thanks to the Trump administration. Of course, the lawsuits are continuing and may be decided against the Trump administration, but that could take years. What I think it's going to take is a new president reversing that interpretation and reversing that gag rule and that interpretation of what Title X money can be spent on.
All right.
Number four, let me just here. Number four on my list is the U.S. military stopped issuing critical data about the war in Afghanistan. The war in Afghanistan has been going on for 18 years now. And up until this year, every 3 months since at least 2010, the U.S. military released a report to the public estimating how much of the country of Afghanistan is controlled by the Taliban versus controlled by the U.S.-supported government in Kabul. This year, the U.S. military command in Afghanistan announced that they would no longer provide that information. Recent reports had shown that the Taliban were gaining ground while the government in Kabul was losing ground. For example, last January's assessment by the U.S. military showed that the government in Kabul controlled territory inhabited by about 63.5% of the population, just under two-thirds of the country, and that was a 1.7% decrease from the previous quarter. The Afghan military and police forces are understaffed, plagued with desertions, and full of what are called ghost soldiers. Those are non-existent personnel whose salaries are pocketed by their corrupt commanders. Now remember, U.S. taxpayer money funds the Afghan military. It's funded almost entirely on U.S. taxpayer money. Now, in July of last year, the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction found that the U.S. government had wasted more than $15 billion of U.S. taxpayer money over the last 11 years in Afghanistan. That's just money that they can't account for. It's not money that they can account for that they know was wasted. It's money that they just can't find. The Pentagon said in February of last year that it spends a total of about $45 billion per year in U.S. taxpayer money to pursue the war in Afghanistan. And while it's difficult to separate the total cost of the war in Afghanistan from the war in Iraq, a figure of over $1 trillion is often cited, most recently in the Washington Post through some of the documents that they've been able to get access to from the U.S. government. But I think a figure of over $2 trillion is far more likely. In the meantime, September's general elections in Afghanistan led to months of protests because of irregularities in the election process, and a three-month delay in releasing the election results has led to widespread unrest and claims of fraud in the recent Afghanistan elections. This has gotten very little coverage in the U.S. press, and yet it's gotten widespread coverage in the international press. Instead of ending the U.S.'s endless wars, as Donald Trump has boasted that he would do, the Trump administration appears to be just trying to ignore them and hoping that everybody else here in the United States is ignoring them too. But the global community has been paying attention, and we should be paying more attention here as well.
That seems to be a reoccurring theme in a lot of your stories.
Yeah, that's what this is all about, Mike. It's all about what news the U.S. press is not covering.
Yeah.
Now, Number five on my list is Donald Trump abusing his emergency powers to finalize arms deals halted by Congress. Now, we've been hearing a lot about Trump's crimes, Donald Trump's crimes, and what he should be impeached for. And one of his crimes is that he has used his emergency powers for things that would benefit him and his business buddies and that are not real emergencies. Mike Pompeo sent letters to Congress saying that Donald Trump was going to use his emergency powers to finalize 22 arms deals with Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Jordan, supposedly in an effort to deter Iran. Pompeo provided no information in those letters or after he issued those letters about what triggered this emergency or why the deals had to be finalized immediately or what threat Iran was to the United States at that time. The deals included $8.1 billion worth of missiles, bombs, drones, aircraft parts, repair and maintenance services, and other weapons. In early April, both houses of Congress had voted to end support for Saudi Arabia's aerial bombing campaign of its neighbor, Yemen, which the United States provides a lot of military support for that bombing campaign. Trump vetoed that bill at the time. Congress then delayed finalizing weapons sales to Saudi Arabia and its ally, the United Arab Emirates, as a way to try to delay the U.S. providing that support for the bombing in Yemen. So Donald Trump turned around and just decided to go around Congress and essentially abuse his emergency powers to ensure that he and his business partners in Saudi Arabia can continue their war and continue making money off of it. There was no new crisis with Iran that these weapons were meant to address. For example, one deal that Trump used his emergency powers to approve provided help with manufacturing F-18 aircraft in Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia doesn't use F-18s in their own air force. Instead, they sell those planes to other countries for a profit. Some of their biggest customers are South Korea, India, and Israel. So that's a direct example in which Donald Trump was using and abusing his emergency powers as president to make sure that military deals that would benefit his friends, his business buddies in Saudi Arabia and the Middle East could go ahead. And I think that
And the U.S. manufacturers for that stuff.
Yeah, and the U.S. companies that provide those weapons and military parts
They're
to Saudi Arabia.
They're friends with everyone in power.
Oh, yes. That is a direct example in which Donald Trump went around Congress, abused his powers as president to benefit himself and his friends. And that did not get nearly enough press this year. Number six on my list, and you might remember this, Donald Trump's tax returns from 1985 to 1994 show that he's America's biggest loser. The New York Times published a long piece on Tuesday, May 7th, which was very quickly forgotten by the rest of the U.S. press, entitled, quote, "Decade in the Red, Trump Tax Figures Show Over $1 Billion in Business Losses," end quote. Donald Trump campaigned on his record as a successful businessman and a self-made billionaire. Now, it turns out that his $1 billion was $1 billion in losses, racked up from 1985 through the mid-1990s. And that $1 billion was not really his own money, but money he borrowed from banks to make bad business deals on luxury properties, hotels, apartment buildings, and casinos that lost money continuously for a decade. The Times took its information from IRS tax transcripts, which Donald Trump has described as inaccurate. But I should point out, as someone who works in a tax accounting office, that tax transcripts are the definitive record of a taxpayer's income and deductions for any given year. Okay, they're the definitive record. They're used in audits, in loan applications, in legal cases in tax court, and they're used by many tax preparers to prepare tax returns when the original documents are not available. Okay, so for example, if you don't have a copy of your W-2, your tax preparer can get a tax transcript from the IRS that has your W-2 information on it. That's what tax transcripts are. Now, the only time a tax transcript from that long ago might not be correct is if you later file an amended return. But I really doubt that Donald Trump has filed 10 amended returns for that entire decade and that he's done it so recently that the IRS tax transcripts won't be up to date. Now, the New York Times compared Trump's losses to an annual sampling of high-income earners provided by the IRS. They found that Donald Trump seems to have lost more money than nearly any other American during that time period, which may explain why his current tax returns seem to be under perpetual audit. The IRS is going to want to look at every detail when a businessman has that type of track record to make sure that he's not committing tax fraud. And I just want to point out that having lost more money than nearly any other American over a single decade really makes you America's biggest loser. In 2018, Bloomberg Business estimated that Donald Trump is currently worth about $2.5 billion. Forbes has upgraded that by saying it's now about $3.1 billion. But I want to also point out that the loans Trump has taken from Deutsche Bank are at least $2 billion over the last two decades and could be higher than that now with accumulated interest. He also reportedly owes money to the Bank of China and up to 150 other creditors, including Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan, BlackRock, Prudential, MetLife, Merrill Lynch, and many others, according to the Wall Street Journal. And that's not counting the many, many, many small subcontractors who do work for him and who he never pays. Financial pundits have pointed out that his many golf properties, including Mar-a-Lago, all operate in the red, meaning that none of them make money from year to year. Those properties and his hotel and apartment buildings all carry large mortgages. Add those to operating loans, construction loans, and lines of credit, and he could be deeply, deeply in debt. In fact, so many banks and financial institutions own a piece of him that it's no wonder Trump's been busy taking apart financial regulations like the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We may talk a lot about which Democratic candidates are beholden to Wall Street, but then there's Donald Trump, right? Okay, so number seven on my list is the Trump administration sitting on disaster recovery funds approved by Congress. As of early September of this year, the Trump administration was sitting on more than two-thirds of the $107 billion that Congress had approved in disaster aid to help people recover from natural disasters like Hurricane Dorian and the wildfires of 2017 and 2018. Excuse me. HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department, had spent only $75 million out of $37 billion that it had received from Congress to help communities rebuild, including fixing roads, water and drainage systems, and rebuilding destroyed homes and businesses. FEMA has simplified its application process, but also added more layers of oversight and review as Republicans fretted this year that money might be wasted on fraud. This has slowed to a crawl the entire process of awarding grants under the Trump administration. In addition, state governments have added their own layers of oversight and review because of worries that the Trump administration will try to claw back any money that they think was wasted or misspent on rebuilding. As a consequence, in September, FEMA had spent about $8 billion left of the $37 billion that Congress gave it to spend on disasters in 2017 and 2018. HUD was far worse, with Ben Carson's agency still sitting on 99% of the $73 billion that Congress had appropriated to spend on disaster recovery for 2017 and 2018, and that's unconscionable. Partly that's because HUD was never designed to be a disaster recovery agency, so it has to reinvent the wheel every time a major disaster occurs. An experienced administrator at HUD might get things moving a whole lot faster than someone like Ben Carson, who is just not that guy. In the meantime, Congress could and should pass laws setting up a new separate permanent agency to handle contracts for rebuilding after natural disasters. FEMA is the first line responder, but we really need an agency to provide longer term rebuilding with an eye towards climate proofing our infrastructure whenever it needs to be replaced. And I should point out that this is one element of the Green New Deal legislation that was introduced by progressive Democrats this year in the House and that's been languishing in the House of Representatives.
I hate to interject, but I also want to point out that currently our director of HUD and Trump are working on a big plan they're rolling out for dealing with homelessness,
yes,
which we can anticipate that's going to be a disaster that's
as well, yeah.
Build on this.
Okay, so I've got three more left on my list, and we're running a little bit short on time.
So why don't you cherry pick?
I'll try to go a little quicker here. Okay. Number eight is the Mueller report released in March did not exonerate Donald Trump. It was heavily redacted by Attorney General William Barr, who is, it turns out, not an impartial Attorney General. In fact, he lied and said that Robert Mueller had not found obstruction of justice when the report says, quote, "If we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. Based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, however, we are unable to reach that judgment," end quote. That's number eight on my list. Just a reminder to people that the Mueller report should have been part of the impeachment process, and it wasn't. That was underreported by the U.S. media. Number nine on my list is red baiting in the presidential elections. We spent several weeks on this show evaluating the top polling Democratic presidential candidates based on their policy proposals on different topics. That was a deep dive you're not going to find anywhere else on the air. That evaluation showed that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are proposing policies that fit squarely within the traditions of the Democratic Party. They're not extremist positions. On the other hand, the other leading candidates, including Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg, support policies that I think would have been standard Republican talking points a generation ago. Yet the corporate national media keeps shamelessly red-baiting Sanders and Warren while promoting what they call the moderate policies of Biden and Buttigieg. And sure, those policies may look moderate next to what the fascist criminal in the White House is proposing and doing, but let's not pretend that Biden and Buttigieg are Democrats. They are corporatists, pure and simple. And the true Democrats are Warren and Sanders. Number 10 on my list is, and the final one on my list, is income inequality is setting the Middle East on fire and other nations around the world as well. In November, we saw massive anti-government protests in Lebanon, Iraq, and Algeria, some of them continuing through December. In Iraq, weeks of protests have pushed for the removal of the entire government put into place after the U.S. invasion because of corruption, mismanagement, lack of government services, and growing income inequality. In Lebanon, weeks of protests brought down Lebanon's Prime Minister, Saad Hariri, because of corruption, mismanagement, and sectarian favoritism, which have led to massive income inequality there. In Algeria, protesters demonstrated for months to push out a military hierarchy that's been in power for over 50 years. Again, corruption is one of the reasons. Hopes for a secular democracy is another reason, but also terrible income inequalities there. The Middle East leads the world in income inequality, with the top 10% of the wealthiest Middle Easterners controlling as much as two-thirds of the region's income. The bottom 50% of the population has to share only 10% of the region's wealth. In comparison, in the U.S., the top 10% controls 47% of the nation's income, and in Europe, the top 10% claims 36%. But because there's more resources to go around in the U.S. and in Europe, we don't feel the disparity as badly as people in the Middle East do. And in fact, the Middle East is losing most of its resources to Western oil companies, so there's much less to go around there to after Western companies take their piece out of the Middle East. This trend is expected to get only worse over time. In short, the Arab Spring is not over, not by a long shot. And that rounds out my list of the top 10 underreported stories this year.
you have any events?
Yeah, I do have four events today. Sunrise Seattle meeting is hosted by the Sunrise Movement Washington. You can go and work on a strategy to stop the climate crisis and make the Green New Deal a reality. That's from 6:30 to 8:15 p.m. at Gethsemane Lutheran Church at 911 Stewart Street in downtown. Also today is the Winter Solidarity Party for New Dawn Guatemala. You can go and show support for community justice in rural Guatemala. There will be live Latin music, food and drink, and a prize giveaway. That's from 7 to 10:30 p.m. at 2021 Northeast 75th Street in North Seattle. Tomorrow is the Harm Reduction Sunday, hosted by the Seattle Harm Reduction Alliance. Join them downtown on 3rd Avenue to hand out harm reduction supplies, including food, clothing, and Narcan. Donations of supplies are also appreciated. That's from 2 to 4 p.m. at 1539 3rd Avenue at Pine Street downtown. And then next Sunday, January 5th, is a rally to rally against the Three Percenters militia and their right-wing racist supporters. This is also a drive to collect winter clothing and gear for homeless folks. That's hosted by the Sparkle Brigade and Orchestra from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at City Hall, 600 4th Avenue at James Street downtown.
All right.
And that wraps up our edition of Eat the Airwaves. I just want to remind people, if you support KODX and you like our show, please consider donating to us online at kodxseattle.org. We have a Patreon button at the top of the page and a PayPal button at the bottom. You can also send us a check made out to Earth on the Air Independent Media and mailed to...
You can get the address, actually, if you go to that PayPal link, but it's P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll plan on seeing you back the same time next week.
Yes, I'll be here.
All right.